broadcasting from Cardiff and across the world on the internet. I'm Kevin Moore and welcome to The Moore Show. For the next hour, I will cover subjects of an alternative variety that most shows do not touch. On today's show, I am joined by Philip Mantle, author of The Alien Inquest and many other UFO books, and we will discuss his research into the Anton Deck alien autopsy film. So stay tuned, enjoy, and we'll be right back.
Missed a show or a guest? Want to know more about The Moore Show and upcoming guests? Then log on to www.themooreshow.co.uk. Listening to The Moore Show, and here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Philip Mantle is the former director of investigations for the British UFO Research Association and was the Mutual UFO Network's representative for England for many years. He is an honorary member of the Research Institute on Anomalous Phenomena in the Ukraine. He is an international lecturer on the subject of UFOs and has worked for a variety of TV and radio companies around the world. Philip, welcome to The Moore Show.
My pleasure.
Now, Philip, tell me a bit about yourself and what sparked your interest.
Well, I'm 51 years old. Two lovely daughters growing up, spending my money. But how I got involved in this subject, I mean, I've always been interested in all things weird and wonderful. Ever as far back as I can remember, I was always interested in the paranormal from a very young age. Was the type of lad that when I was at school, for example, when you were asked after the school holidays to stand up in the class and do a talk about what you'd been up to.
Yeah.
You know, I would talk about ghosts and this kind of thing. So I've always been interested. You know, I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested. So it's been with me all my life.
Okay, now you've written three books, Mystery Skies, the UFO Phenomena, Without Consent, Beyond Roswell, and your newest one, Alien Autopsy. Now let's start with your newest book, Alien Autopsy. How did you come about that book?
Well, the Alien Autopsy Inquest book came about really 10 years ago now is when I started writing it. Unfortunately, 10 years ago I was seriously ill. And it's part of my rehabilitation. You know, the body was weak, but the mind was active.
Of course.
So I'd been involved with the Alien Autopsy film from its inception, from the very, very beginning. So as part of my rehabilitation from my illness, I quite literally would shuffle along to my computer each day and put the book together. You know, I had lots of files, research papers, and so on. And it just grew and grew over the years, did the book, until it was finally finished. And hey presto, it was published. So, you know, had I not been ill, I would probably never got round to putting pen to paper, so to speak. I'd never probably have written it, or probably would have written it a lot much later than I did.
So a sort of gift of a curse then, really?
Well, it was, yeah. I mean, you know, I couldn't get out and about as much as I used to do. So it was, right, keep yourself active. It was one of the things the doctors and nurses we talked about anyway. If you're not physically active, keep your brain going.
Yeah.
So it was rather funny, actually. When the final manuscript was ready, and I checked it, I used to, you know, the old days of floppy disks, I checked the disks, and I'd actually written three of the chapters twice. but it was remarkably similar, the word as well, almost word for word.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had plenty of time on my hands. So that's how it came about. Had I not been ill, it would have probably been much later.
Well, let's start from the beginning then. Let's discuss the original story of Alien Autopsy. And let me say, there was about, 1.2 billion viewers that saw the Alien Autopsy film in 1995. And I suppose experts have been divided over ever since. Now, it all started off with a man called Ray Santilli. Now, how did you become involved, and when did you become involved with Ray Santilli?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long time ago now. I mean, in 1993, I was part of Bufora, and I literally had a phone call out of the blue from Ray Santilli. You know, I still get lots of phone calls. You know, it wasn't anything out of the ordinary. To begin with, Santilli said, would you and Bufora perhaps be able to assist me with the making of a documentary, just a general UFO documentary? And I said, yeah, possibly, you know, explain what we could and couldn't do. The conversation went on over a few months, when eventually, out of the blue, he said, well, you know, I actually have film of the UFO crash at Roswell, and I have one of the beings there being autopsied. So I said, fine, you know, show me. You know, it's all right speaking on the telephone, but show me.
Yeah.
So for a year and a half, it was, yes, I can show you, Philip. No, I can't. Yes, I can. No, you know. So I basically told him to get lost. In between time, I met Ray Santilli once in London. We were actually hosting Travis Walton and Mike Rogers. They were in the UK promoting the movie Fire in the Sky, which had just been released. We put on an evening lecture for them, and Ray Santilli's offices were quite nearby. So I invited him along to meet him in person, which I did. He told me the story of how he'd been in America, stumbled across the film from an alleged military cameraman, and bought it. So again, I said, you know, show me. So in the early part of 1995, I had UFORA's annual conference all organized and ready to go. We used to have it in Sheffield in those days. And I had Ray Santilli's business card, and I'd also been sent a copy of the video of Roswell the movie. It was only a small release in the UK, and that sort of, you know, alerted my memory again. I thought, well, if this Santilli chap still claims to have this film, so I literally got his business card out of my file, rang him up, and he said, yes, Philip, I do, but you don't believe me. I said, well, show me. So he said, right, make an appointment with my secretary at my office, and I'll show you. So I did. And I think it was around about April of 1995, thereabouts, I travelled to London with my wife. We sat in his office and viewed the film. And I thought, well, what do I do now? So I just completely out of the blue, I said, well, will you show it at our conference in August of 1995? And to my surprise, he said yes. The reason for that being, I thought, well, the only way to get to the bottom of this film was to get it out in the open.
Sure.
And, you know, by attaching it to the conference, I knew it would draw some press interest. Never did I realise what would, you know, was going to happen, and it would be a worldwide controversial phenomena. So that's how it all started. You know, quite by chance. I never expected Santilli to agree to show it at the conference, but he did. And as the rest of the say is history.
Now, how did Ray come across the film? And what was Gary Shewfield's involvement with Ray at the time?
Well, Ray had a business partner by the name of Gary Shufield. They worked out of small offices in London. They were buyers and sellers of material. You know, they'd buy back catalogues of material, they'd buy archive film. I mean, Ray is a huge music person. Yeah, that's his main field of business. He's certainly into the 60s music, has a big archive of memorabilia, which he licenses and things like this. And Gary Shufield is his business partner. Now, in 1993, they claim that they went to Cleveland, Ohio, which I have subsequently checked, and they did, looking for, you know, memorabilia, mainly of Elvis and people like that. The reason they went to Cleveland is because that's the kind of area in the 1950s that the then sort of relatively unknown rock stars would tour. They'd do the college circuits. Ray said he bought a piece of film from an old boy, you know, of Elvis, one of, if not some of the earliest film ever shot of an unknown Elvis Presley at the time. Shortly before returning home, this old boy went back to him and said, look, before I was a freelance cameraman, I worked for the US military, and I have film of the aliens at Roswell. Santilli was shown a piece of the film, and he claimed he made a deal then and then to buy it in cash and keep the cameraman's name out of it, keep him anonymous. And that's the story he's pretty much kept since then, although he has changed it here and there.
Yeah.
That was the initial story. So that's what he told me when I first spoke to him about the film when I first met him. And that's how it started.
So have you or any other UFO investigator ever been able to contact or source Ray's Army contact?
Well, I mean, cutting a very long story short, you know, I think it was 1996, an old boy phoned me, claimed to be this man. However, we researched the film from every which way you can look at. I mean, we checked the film stock. I mean, you name it, we checked it. Couldn't prove it was a fake. Couldn't prove it was authentic. The reason we couldn't prove it authentic was Santilli would not make actual celluloid, 16mm celluloid, available for analysis. He gave us bits and pieces, but none that were of any use at all. We were sceptical with certain aspects of Santilli's behaviour, not for any particular evidence. When you look at the film, for those who haven't seen it, it's grainy black and white. You know, the creature's on the slab, and they dissect it, basically. And there's nothing in the film that would give it away as an obvious fake. You know, doctors commented on it, surgeons, I mean, you name it. People commented on it from specialists around the world. The first indication that it's a fake, and it is a fake, is when the special effects experts started to look at it. They could see little things that, to the untrained eye, you and I would never notice. Again, they're not obvious giveaways, but they are an indication that not all is what is claimed to be here. But Santilli stuck to his story. Then a couple of years back, Anton Deck, Saturday Night Entertainers, brought a film out, a movie about the alien autopsy film, and Santilli changed his story. He said that the film that everyone saw on television back in the 90s was a recreation. The original had been damaged, and it was, you know, so he changed his story. However, we were already on to him by that time. The final link in the chain of all this came in towards the end of 2007, when a gentleman by the name of Spiros Malaris telephoned us. Spiros actually owns his own television studio, but he is the man who led the team that faked the alien autopsy. He was, you know, hired, if you like, by Santilli. He employed his own small team, including a sculptor, and they faked the whole thing. The idea originally, according to Spiros, was not to make loads of money, not to have it here, there, and everywhere. It was more of a bit of a laugh. If they made a bit of money out of it, fine. But the idea was to release it, and then in a few months' time, you know, hold the hands up and say, it wasn't really real, it's us, we've had a bit of a laugh out of it. But Spiros claims, you know, he lost interest in it, he had other bits and pieces to do, he had other work, and he just let it go. And, finally he owned up. Not only did he own up, he's named names. I've seen all his research material that he used at the time. He's got telephone conversations with others involved that I've listened to and so on. There is no doubt he is the man who he says he isn't, and the whole thing's a fake. But it's a fascinating story. It's a long, long story. It goes off in many different directions. But that's the alien autopsy film in a nutshell, I'm afraid.
So, as the Ant and Dec film deciphers, was there an original reel that then Ray brought and obviously Sepiros actually watched?
No. No. There is no original film of anything peculiar at all. Nothing.
No.
It's all one con.
So as shown in the film, that is that never really happened, that there was no reel that degenerated. And
there is no original film, either good, bad or indifferent. It did not happen. They did go to Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes.
Because Ray actually did a newspaper article about it when it upon return. I think it was either the Daily Mirror or the Sunday Mirror. About some of the memory, because he didn't just buy film when he was there, he bought some letters that Elvis had written and this kind of thing. So there's an article all about it. So, you know, we've got provenance as to know where he was, but there was no mysterious military cameraman, there was no military film of any description whatsoever.
But
the only archive film that Santilli had was an old baseball film that he and Spiros bought on a market in London.
Yes,
and it
but
was from the period, it was
sure.
You know, period film.
Sure.
They used bits of that to fool others, but there was no film of anything.
But I thought, didn't Sepiros say that he went to London and actually watched what he called the tent film, which was...
That's right. The tent footage is all part of the alien autopsy film. When Santilli sold this to the television companies, that was part and parcel of the package. That was made separately. It's another story by a gentleman called Keith Bateman. Keith was a business associate of Santilli's. And this is how the whole thing started. I mean, Keith is a fascinating chap, and, you know, he's telling you many stories of things they've got involved with. But basically, they used to have brainstorming sessions and come up with crazy ideas to try and make some money. And they were in Keith's office. Santilli was there. Somebody had a book on Roswell, you know, just as a matter of chance, and somebody said, wouldn't it be great if we had some Roswell footage, you know, of the flying saucer crash. So Keith, being a bit of a lad, went ding, and off he went, and he made some, which we called the tent footage. Basically, you've got a creature lying on a slab. It's covered by a white sheet. There's two doctors, if you like, in white coats, pulling giblets out. This was filmed on a farm in a barn, and the giblets are real, but they're from an animal, bought from the local butchers. It's awful. And he darkened it, run it through a computer and so on, put scratches on it. It lasted about 5 or 6 minutes. He then took that, did Keith Bateman, to Santilli and said, there you go. Story that Keith tells us is that Santilli said, well, yeah, it's not bad, but it's not good enough. Go away and get me a budget to do some real good stuff. So Keith, you know, phoned around, got a budget of approximately £45,000, presented that to Santilli, who said, no, I'm not interested. However, the idea had been sown, and it was the tent footage that Keith Bateman made that Santilli then showed to various people, including Spiros Malaris. So there was never any original film. That was all shot on video. We've interviewed Keith and his colleagues, and it, you know, the tent footage was a fake, and that in turn led to the whole story.
And have you seen the tent footage?
I do. I have a copy of it in my office.
And do you think it's fake?
I know it's fake.
Yeah.
There is no doubt about it whatsoever.
Even though Ray stands by saying that, you know, this is authentic.
Well, no, I think if you speak to Santilli now, there was a point that he disowned it himself, because the thing about the two doctors in the tent footage is that their faces aren't covered. And when you get a good copy of it, you can actually make out the face of at least one of these people. And he's actually one of the technicians that used to work for Keith Bateman. He's not a doctor at all. He's called, I think his correct name is Elliot Willis. It's either Elliot Willis or Elliot Wills. I just forget the name, but it's Elliot Willis, I believe. And, you know, I've got a photograph of Elliot, and he's been interviewed. He's one of the doctors in the tent footage. It's not real. It's a fake.
And you've met these people, of course.
I have indeed, yes.
Yeah. But going back to the question then, where does Ray stand nowadays? If you were to speak to the man now.
You have to understand about Ray. I mean, he sold the whole package of the alien autopsy film around the world to a wide variety of television companies, video producers, magazines, newspapers, whatever. He made an awful lot of money out of it. He's made a movie out of it. Various documentaries. So he stands by his story. He cannot do anything but stand by his story, because technically you know, he could be sued because a lot of the contracts, he said, this is genuine military footage of an alien. You know, no matter how much he may change his story, he's still stuck with the fact that he claims to have had original film. I don't think anybody would sue him because it'd be a, you know, they've all made money out of the film. All the television companies made their share as well. But technically speaking, he could.
Well,
and
yeah,
of course, he's
I mean,
a businessman.
I mean, the TV companies, you know, would feel cheated now, wouldn't they?
Well, they could do. But he's also a businessman. I mean, I remember sitting in his office one day, and he was enthused about a box full of photographs he had in his possession that were all unpublished photographs of the Beatles. And he was in the business of licensing some of those. And he came out with a comment. He said, "Well, imagine if the alien autopsy would have film was a fake, what would it do to my other business interests?" So potentially it could have effects in other areas as well. But, you know, he still maintains that he did buy original footage. It's not true, of course, but he can't say anything else.
OK, so he still maintains that he's got 16mm film footage brought from this retired army guy in Ohio, right? Cleveland, Ohio, sorry.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he claims he'll show you some of these. I mean, I've seen some of the bits of film that he claims are from it, I mean, but they're encased in perspex, they've never been analysed, and I would lay odds that they are not vintage bits of film, but the contemporary ones, you know, shot in the 1990s.
And again, he won't release those to you to get analysed.
Absolutely, no. I mean, if you think about it, it'd be like you having the Mona Lisa hanging on your wall, but having no one to authenticate it for you. It'd be worth £4.50, but if it's authenticated, it's worth £400 million, you know? It
yeah.
just doesn't make any sense.
Spiros Malaris, how can you tell he's the genuine article? And I mean, how do you know he's not?
It's not just what Spiros says. I mean, the one thing about Spiros, unlike Ray, is he'll tell you everything, and he'll name names. I mean, he has done. He's named everybody that was involved in it. You know, and we've spoken to the sculptor who made the dummies. Not only that, he didn't just come up with the idea. It wasn't just a thing. When he made it, he went into a great deal of research before he made it. And I've seen all his research files. You know, you don't just put something like that together. You want to make sure that everything in the room was accurate. You know, the utensils that the doctors used, for example, had to be new. It couldn't be old because, you know, they would look antique. They'd be out of place. And so he went into it in minute detail.
Sure.
Also, there were others involved. I mean, Santilli said that he didn't have the money to buy the film. So he turned to his business partner, a German chap by the name of Volker Spielberg. And Volker put the money up to buy it. That's Santilli's story in his own words. Well, you know, we have listened to tape-recorded interviews with Volker Spielberg, done by Spiros, and Spielberg will tell you. I don't know why he's saying this. We all knew it's a fake. You know, he tells you straight out in the open. I don't know why Santilli keeps to this story. It's a fake. Spiros is writing his own book, by the way, and all this is going in there, so that's why I've been privy to it.
Sure.
Santilli released other bits of pieces of things as well. He released the boxes or photocopies of the boxes that the film was stored in with labels on and what type of film it was. Well, that was all from Kodak. I mean, again, Spiros has a big file of all the original faxes that he got from Kodak to get the information about what film they should have used in 1947. So he did the full research job.
And obviously these documents are real. I mean, they date back to the early 1990s.
Yes, because when they came through the fax machine, you know, they've got the date on it.
So
if you don't just take him at face value, you take all the things added up.
Of course.
It all fits into place.
Of course. Now, if Spiros Malaris had this friend, Volker Spielberg, who funded the film in the end, funded the film to mimic, obviously, what the temp footage was showing, yeah?
Yeah.
Why keep Ray involved then? I mean, if Volker was funding the project then, from there onwards, why keep Ray?
Well, out of all this, Ray was the front man. You know, he was the front man. But what Santilli did, he got the tent footage, which was made by Keith Bateman, and he spun this story to Spiros, saying, you know, I originally bought this, and it's, you know, it's no good, it's rubbish. And Spiros said, well, we'll make it for you, you know, I'll make it for you, which he did. You know, he got a budget of, I think it was £30,000. They run out of money in the end, because one of the dummies that they made went wrong, so they had to do another one, and Spiros even put his own money into it just to get it finished. And he said, there you go, job done. It was a job. You know, we're talking here, 1995. Spiros wasn't as wealthy as he is now, although he wasn't broke, but it was a job to him, and he wanted to do as best he could.
Of course.
There's the finished product, Ray. You know, it was all going to be a bit of a laugh. They're going to release it, and then 6 months later, stand up and say, this is how we did it. But nobody, and I mean nobody, I mean, I was in Santilli's office when the telephone calls were coming in from the various... Nobody knew how much interest would be generating this thing. I mean, that was just pure luck. And, of course, then the pound sign started. And everybody outside of Santilli's office who wasn't involved in UFOs were oblivious to this. Spiros went on to do, whatever he was doing and never took much notice of it down the years.
Did Spiros get his initial investment? Well, did Spiros get his money back? And did his friend...
He got a small amount of money back, but he paid his crew. He paid his crew rather than anything for himself. He wasn't in it to make money. It was just a paid job that he did. Obviously, he wasn't broke or anything like that, but any little bits of money that they were paid went to his crew and not himself. Humphreys is the sculptor.
Sure,
but
sure.
If you look at John's work online. He also worked on the Ant and Dec film. And John's gone on the record and said, I made the dummies. That's not a secret. So he paid his crew first, like any good producer does.
So who paid Volker Spielberg back then, the initial
Nobody.
Funder?
Volker's never, from the telephone conversations and interviews I've listened to, Spielberg never got any money back. I think he's fairly wealthy anyway, but I don't think he got any money back.
Well, I wouldn't say that sort of added up, would you? I mean, if someone was back then was going to put $30,000 into a secret project like this, I mean, obviously you'd want that money back, and it doesn't
Want it. You'd want it, but he says he didn't get it. It may be lost in translation. He is German. It may be that he never made any money on it. He may have gotten his initial investment back.
So then my question comes back then to why was Ray if it was Volker's money who funded the project, then why all of a sudden did Ray take over? And
like I said, initially, nobody knew how much money this thing was going to generate.
No.
I mean, to begin with, there were no television companies involved whatsoever. People have found this hard to believe, but I know it's a fact, because what Ray's initial idea was going to be was to release it on video. And if you wanted it, the only way to get it was to buy it from him on video. And he did sell it on video as well. And it was my fault. I accidentally released it to a journalist, just, again, purely by accident. And then the story went around the world. And that's when the television people then became interested. So things changed. So from the outset, nobody knew that there was going to be any significant amounts of money involved at all.
Okay.
And it just grew and grew and snowballed and snowballed. It's about the only accurate thing in the Ant and Dec film is how much money that they made. It did just snowball. The Americans, for example, paid $250,000 to show it on television, plus video rights on top of that. So that'll give you an idea. There was a bit of a bidding war went on, and, Santilli cashed in. And but because others weren't involved in UFOs or weren't interested, if you weren't involved in it, you wouldn't have known how much interest that the alien autopsy had generated around the world. I mean, have you seen the Japanese programs that were made, for example?
Sure.
It was licensed in Russia. They had to edit it for it to be shown in Saudi Arabia and so on. And unless someone tells you it's been shown in Japan, you wouldn't have a clue. So, Santilli, in that respect, as far as his so-called business contacts or his business partners were concerned, he kept them pretty much in the dark, but cashed it in, and coined it in, and there you go.
Okay, so we'll leave it at that. Volker Spielberg, he was well-funded, and he just walked away.
£30,000 is a lot of money,
sure,
certainly to you or I, but
sure.
I think, with somebody like Volker, it may not have been that, a huge amount of money. He's a fairly wealthy man in his own right. And I've known, a friend of mine was very wealthy, and for him to lose £30,000 or £40,000, he wouldn't have battered an eyelid. It's like a fiver to you or I.
Sure.
So, we're talking in different terms, I'm afraid.
Did you ever get to meet Volker Spielberg?
I have met him, but I didn't know who he was at the time. I never got a chance to speak to him or ask him any questions. Ray's office used to be chaos. I used to wonder how he earned a living. You know, there was a chap there, and I didn't realise until I saw a photograph afterwards who it was, and it was Volker Spielberg. So I have met him, never got a chance to quiz him about anything.
And I take it that Spiros Malaros wasn't able to come forward due to a confidentiality agreement signed between them, himself and
That's
Ray at
right.
the time.
They all signed an agreement, but when Spiros says, you know, when the Ant and Dec film was released, that then their agreement was over and done with, because Santilli was telling a pack of lies, basically. And, you know, as far as he was concerned, the agreement was over, it was finished, and off they went. You know, he decided then to tell the truth, to tell the facts. He didn't quite know the best way to go about it, and eventually ended up, you know, with us, with me, and the story is out there.
Now, in the film, it shows Volker Spielberg, a.k.a. the Hungarian art dealer, being run over by a car, but obviously Spielberg is still here to talk about
Absolutely.
The story.
I mean, I think he's German or Austrian. He's German by origin. He lives in Switzerland. He's a very wealthy man. From what I've been told about him, he's quite a peculiar man. Very, how can I say, blunt on certain issues, which are shown to a little bit in tongue-in-cheek, in fact, in the movie. You and I would probably call him a racist. Doesn't like people of a homosexual persuasion.
Okay.
But on the other hand, you know, Spiros has told me he's a lovely man. You know, he's got his own likes and dislikes. He can be quite blunt, but he's a very nice chap. I wouldn't know. I don't know him. But he's still around, I can assure you. And I've listened to the telephone interviews with him and look forward to seeing all of them when they're finally publishing the book.
Sure, of course. It's going to be interesting. In the film, it showed Ant and Dec being followed by secret agents. I mean, was that ever experienced by Ray and...
No. I mean he was stalked by ufologists, was Santilli, and by television companies, and I've seen that firsthand. But, you know, and everybody and their dog were trying to get their hands on his film. I think at one point he claimed to have his computer hacked into in his office, and, you know, bits and pieces... I think when he was in, I think it was Italy, they had something stolen from their hotel room. But nothing sinister. I mean, even Ray will tell you there was nothing like that involved at all. That just adds a bit of intrigue to the movie, I think.
And what does Ray do now?
Much the same as he's ever done. I mean, Ray's always, you know, buying and selling. Music's has always been his main business. And
yeah.
He still has offices not far from where I first met him in London. And still doing the same thing. But on a bit of a grander scale.
And is there any sort of future documentaries planned for an anniversary sort of alien autopsy documentary? Or?
Well, I mean, there's been a few people interested in the Spiros Malaris story. But again, you know, Spiros, to his credit, hasn't taken up on the offers. Because, A, he doesn't need the money, whatever they may be paying. He's not bothered about the money. He wants to make sure he's got his book and his facts and he's crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's first. And then, if they're still interested, then they could perhaps, you know, speak to him then. So there is interest, but there's interest in putting it to bed, if you like, you know, finally closing the lid on the alien autopsy film. So that would never surprise me if that didn't happen at some point in the future. But there are people interested in it, both in the UK and the United States, and I know that for a fact because they've telephoned me and asked, you know. So it's not a rumour, it's a fact.
Sure. I mean, what's Gary's take on all this? I mean, has Gary remained very quiet? Is he easy
well,
to
Gary
approach?
Gary Shoofield was always a player in the background. I mean, again, I've met Gary several times. He always maintained he was just a bit part player in it anyway. You know, he is a business partner of Ray's. When it came to the story about the cameraman, he said he never met him or anything like that. You know, Ray, he didn't see him. So he's always sort of remained like a silent partner, I think you would call it, so to speak. But he's always backed Ray's story up wherever possible. So, but he's still around. He's worked for a variety of companies. And, you know, I met him last year, the year before, in London with Ray, and had lunch with them. So
sure.
He's still there.
Sure. And so he'll back up. Null out basically Spiros Malaris' story. He will say that's a lie. Would he Gary?
Will, yes, he will support everything Santilli says.
Yeah.
You would expect your business partner to do that.
When you sat with them, I mean, how do they come across? Do they come across
well,
as?
Well, I mean, you know, Ray's a really likable chap. I've had a lot to do with Ray, not so much with Gary. But I've had an awful lot of dealings with Sam Tilliott, and I found him very approachable. You know, I've wined and dined with him, in London.
Yeah.
Always very approachable, very nice, very chatty, very pleasant, laughing, joking. You know, nice man. If he was a neighbour, you'd probably get on like a house on fire. I'm not sure I'd ever buy anything from him. You know, that's just experience. But he's a very likable chap.
But you would say they're both lying and covering
absolutely,
up.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're lying through their teeth. The film is a 100% fake.
Yeah.
Spiros and his crew made it. You know, there was never any original 16mm film. There's no mysterious military cameraman. It's all a con, made for money.
Okay, Philip, we're going to take a break there, so stay tuned and we'll be right back.
To connect with the show, email kevin@themoreshow.co.uk.
I'm lost without you, can't help myself. How does it feel to know that I love you, baby? I'm lost without you, can't help myself. How does it feel to know that I love you, baby? Tell me how you love me more, and how you think I'm sexy, babe. But you don't want nobody else, you don't want this guy, you don't want that guy. You wanna touch yourself when you see me. Tell me how you love my body, and how I make you feel, babe. You wanna roll with me, you wanna hold with me, you wanna stay warm and get out of the cold with me. I just love to hear you say it, it makes a man feel good, babe. Tell me you depend on me, I need to hear it. I'm lost without you, can't help myself. How does it feel to know that I love you, baby? I'm lost without you, can't help myself. How does it feel to know that I love you, baby? Baby, you're the perfect shape. Baby, you're the perfect weight. Treat me like my birthday. I want it this way, I want it that way. I want it. Tell me you don't want me to stop.
Don't stop.
Tell me it would break your heart that you love me and all my dirty. You wanna roll with me, you wanna hold with me, you wanna make vows and get Norwegian wood with me. I just love to hear you say it, it makes a man feel good, baby. I'm lost without you, can't help myself. How does it feel to know that I love you, baby? I'm lost without you, can't help myself. How does it feel to know that I love you, baby? 'Cause you will tell me every morning, ooh, all right, babe. Oh yeah, oh baby, oh darling.
You're listening to The Moore Show, and here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Okay, welcome back. I'm joined with ufologist Philip Mantle. So yourself and Spiros Malaris would say that something definitely happened in Roswell.
Well, yeah, I mean, Spiros himself has been out to Roswell, and I was fortunate myself to visit there in 2007. I don't think anyone would doubt that something happened at Roswell. Even the American Air Force will say, yes, something happened at Roswell. They claim it was a balloon. So something definitely did happen there. The argument has always been, exactly what? I mean, I don't profess to know what happened at Roswell, you know, and the argument still rages. You know, it's not something that's gone away. New information tends to come out on a regular basis, even after all these years. And more information has just come out about it recently. So, you know, Roswell
That's right.
itself, will, you know, is entirely different to the alien autopsy film. But I think the research that we did, you know, it's to our benefit in the end. It shows that we're willing to go to great lengths to try and find the answers.
Have you ever had anyone approach you by phone or you know, in person, that knew someone that what sort of, you know, 20 to 30 years ago may have watched something way before this even footage was sort of came out with,
well,
with
there,
Ray.
There are a number of people. There's a small number of people, only one of whom I've actually interviewed in person, who claimed to have seen something similar. This is a chap, he's in the UK, he's never been in the military, and his name is Mike Maloney. Mike was the chief photographer for the Mirror Group newspapers for many, many years. He is the most highly decorated press photographer there's ever been. He was press photographer of the years, I think 4 years running. He now has a PhD, he works for himself. And a colleague put me in touch with Mike, and he claims in the 1970s he was flown to Disney in California to actually cover a number of Disney movies as part of his job. And again, cutting a long story very short, because he was a professional photographer, he was invited to a private screening of some films one evening by one of the producers at Disney. And the films were UFOs, flying saucers, and they were genuine. You know, these weren't Disney recreations. And lo and behold, there's a, you know, piece of film pops up that Mike said, you know, is remarkably similar to the alien autopsy film. That, you know, the creatures look similar. There were no notable differences, but quite similar. And he was absolutely amazed. And he thought, you know, this will be big news. And was surprised that he never heard any more about it. And I've seen Mike's diary. He always carries a little pocket diary. He keeps them. And he showed me his diary from that time period. It's all noted in there. So make of it what you will. But it's nothing to do with Santilli, but, you know, Mike claims to have seen something very, very similar.
So maybe Santilli did see something and, you know, has just come up with this elaborate idea, well, the idea he did come up with, which was to copy something close to it, maybe. I don't know.
Well,
who
that's
knows?
Highly unlikely.
Yeah.
But, you know, irrespective, the what you see on the screen is a fake. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah, and I suppose maybe Ray's told a few too many lies to know where the sort of the line of the truth is.
Well, he's told plenty of porkies in his time, so yes.
Okay. Now, moving on to your other book, your Mystery Sky, Soviet UFO Phenomena. Now, was you a co-author of that book? Or
that's right, Mysterious Sky. I've co-authored that with a chap by the name of Paul Stonehill. Paul lives in the United States, but originally he's from the Ukraine. So his real name is Pavel. So,
okay.
But Paul's lived in the U.S. since he was about 13 or 14, I think. And in the late 1980s is when I first met Paul, and we exchanged a lot of information. The thing about the former Soviet Union, the USSR topic was the communist regime, which is gone, and then there was on top of that was the language barrier. Now, you know, with Paul being a former Soviet citizen, he speaks and reads and writes the language fluently. Now, there was a big sighting at a place called Voronezh in the late 1980s in all the national newspapers. And for some reason, I was interviewed by a Soviet newspaper, one of their main newspapers. And I got lots of letters from Russia as a result thereafter, people reporting sightings to me. I couldn't read most of it. It was in Russian, so... You know, I collaborated with Paul. We worked on a book that Paul did some years later. I helped him with. And then there came a point when we'd both got lots of research material from all over the place, and we decided to pool our resources. Because if you look around, if people are there listening this evening have UFO books, there aren't that many that come, you know, or deal with things in the former Soviet Union. So decided to pool our resources and put the book together, which became Mysterious Sky. It's a quite a large book in words. You know, there's I think it's about 160,000 words. It was a lot bigger than that. We edited it down.
Yeah.
And so we did that for a number of reasons. We produced the book for a number of reasons, but one of the books was to give credit to, you know, Soviet UFO researchers. I mean, you have to remember there was a time under the various communist regimes, they were under the threat of death. UFOs was a banned subject in Russia. And they risked life and limb, something that we've never experienced in the West, thankfully. So there is a part of the book that, you know, pays tribute to them. And also to show that, you know, whatever UFOs are, it doesn't know any international boundaries. And the Soviet Union was no different. There's an awful lot of information there and still is, you know. So it was an untapped resource, if you like, and we're both very pleased with it.
Yeah, it's some good stories there. I mean, obviously you've done your research into Soviet stories. Now, there's one sort of report that I know you worked on, which was the Soviet Mir space station and what the cosmonauts saw. Could you just go over that story just for
Absolutely.
Us briefly?
Absolutely, I mean, I was fortunate enough a few years ago to be lecturing in the Republic of San Marino, and I met a cosmonaut who'd been on the Mir space station, and he was there complete with his medal, a hero of the Soviet Union. I can't, you know, in a thousand years pronounce his name, but he was a Soviet cosmonaut. And there's always been rumors that A, the American astronauts, and B, the cosmonauts actually saw things whilst in space. And as far as long space trips are concerned, you know, the Soviets, you know, hold all the records for lengthy stays in space. So they were more likely to be, you know, have access to seeing things. And of course, once the barriers came down, so to speak, others became involved, you know, and, you know, UFOs were seen by the cosmonauts, and these aren't the sort of wink-wink, nudge-nudge rumors like you get from the Apollo astronauts and things like that. These were all on the record.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were seen from Mir, they were seen from various missions that the Soviets launched. And so we put a whole chapter together about that, and you know it's fascinating stuff. I mean, they talk about taking photographs of it, seeing these strange light forms. Some of them also went on to say it had an effect on them, not necessarily the space trip, but the things that they saw out there. It affected them mentally, it puzzled them. You know, this shouldn't be there. They weren't saying they were aliens or anything like that, but there was certainly a phenomenon in space that they didn't expect to see, and they don't know what it was. So, again, it's a fascinating aspect of the whole subject.
What's your views on current NASA astronauts that go up there nowadays? Do you think that they see objects that they cannot explain and they cannot talk about neither?
I'm pretty sure they do, yes. I mean, again, most of the information that you find on the internet, for example, about the NASA astronauts, you know, it's just a nonsense. But we're fortunate there are one or two who have gone on the record and said yes. You know, I mean, Gordon Cooper, although he's sadly no longer with us, he saw UFOs prior to being a NASA astronaut. He was a test pilot. I think it was flying over Germany when he saw them. He was also involved with the alleged obtaining a film of UFOs while he was, after he'd finished at NASA, but still employed by them, and he claimed he went and, you know, a UFO was filmed landing at a particular airbase, at Holloman Air Base, and he was in charge of the film. He went and picked it up. So, and he went on the record with that. And so, you know, I'm pretty sure they do see phenomena in space that they can't explain.
Yeah.
On occasion, not every occasion. Whether there's a gag to stop them speaking or not, I honestly don't know. It wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me. But you know, I don't forget we've got a Brit going up in a few years' time. Maybe he's going up with the European Space Agency.
That's right.
Maybe he'll tell us if he sees it.
That's right.
But there certainly is a phenomenon in space that they have commented on. Yes.
Yeah. Now, going back to the Soviet files, there was a story being carried on that there was UFOs over Chernobyl. Is that true?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. When the Chernobyl disaster happened, there were UFO sightings in the area both before, during, and after. Now, it depends on which way you look at the UFO phenomena. Some people look at it as a reflection of sort of human psyche. That, you know, whenever we're under under stress in large areas, that you know, we somehow manifest these strange things in the sky. But yes, UFOs were seen, you know, on or around Chernobyl, you know, on a fairly regular basis. And again, it wasn't until after the Soviet Empire collapsed, if you like, the Berlin Wall came down, the Iron Curtain collapsed, that we could find out more information about these. I mean, a lot of these sightings were made by, you know, the general population, but there were others involved as well.
Of course.
And it, you know, whether they were genuine UFOs, whether it was something that that was part of the disaster that happened. You know, again, he's open to conjecture and theory, but you know, certainly were sightings made at the time. Yes.
Now there was one sort of famous one back in 1908, wasn't there? The Tunguska. Is that how you pronounce it?
Tunguska. Yeah,
Tunguska. I mean, sorry. Yes.
Tunguska's out in the Taiga.
That's right.
It's a very remote region of the former Soviet Union. And for those that are not aware, it was a huge, great blast. Something came to Earth, almost looked like an atomic bomb had gone off. It flattened the trees for miles and miles and miles. It wasn't an Earth impact. In other words, it didn't hit the ground. Whatever it came, it exploded above the ground, like an atomic bomb does. An atomic bomb doesn't hit the ground. It explodes in the atmosphere. And there weren't any big cities in this area, thankfully. There are small tribes, people that live there, and they, you know, remember seeing this. And you can still see the devastation today, although a lot of the trees have grown back. You can still see them. Professor Kulik from the Academy of Sciences went a few years later. They didn't go straight away. I was stunned by what they saw. I mean, the blast was so big and so bright, it even lit up the UK at midnight. You know, that's how bright it was.
Wow.
Now, I mean, if that was to have happened today over a major city, anywhere in the world, then it would kill hundreds of thousands of people. You know, it's as simple as that.
If now, not millions, yeah.
Was this a meteor? Was it, some form of antimatter? Was it a comet? Or was it, you know, something not of this world, i.e. a spaceship? And there are some Russian scientists, do not ask me to quote their names.
Sure.
If that was Paul's job in the book, he had to spell check those. And they are convinced that it was not of this Earth, because one of the things that the local people that lived there, and it's sparsely populated, said that it actually seemed, whatever this thing was, when it was coming in, it seemed to change course. Whereas natural bodies that come to Earth, like meteors and comets or whatever, don't. You know, they come from A to B and boom. So, again, there's a lot of speculation, but Tunguska happened. You know, there's no denying it.
The
devastation is there for all to see. There is a Tunguska society, if you like, that still study it to this day. I still go back there and make research trips. And it's, again, it's a fascinating story in its own right.
That's right.
And it's, you know, smack bang in the outback, we'd call it, in the middle of nowhere, but it's there all right.
Now, I also hear that there was many pilot-reported sightings back then as well, in the sort of Soviet era.
There was a particular sighting in Russia that sparked official interest. The sighting may or may not have been a rocket. It really doesn't matter. You know, sometimes when a rocket goes up, it leaves a peculiar glow in the sky. However, it prompted the Soviet authorities, unknown to anyone outside of the Soviet Union, to put everybody in the Soviet military on UFO watch, if you like. And at that point, you're talking millions of people. That was from the lowest clerk to the highest ranking official and everybody in between. So the Soviets actually launched the biggest, when you talk about manpower, UFO research project ever. We also got the KGB files released. So we've had those translated into English. And they literally would go and interview pilots, both civilian and military, and we have the transcripts of the sightings that they saw as well. So there probably is more and more files of that nature lying languishing in some vaults somewhere, you know, gathering dust, but we certainly got some released. Our Russian colleagues, they passed them on to us, we had them translated.
Sure.
So there was a huge project there as well, and of course what we've seen down the years, of course, we're talking now about, you know, the Ministry of Defence files being released slowly but surely. KGB files were released long before this, long before Britain ever released anything. So, you know, they were sort of forerunners to official release of information, if you like, but some fascinating things were reported.
And what was the results of the studies in the end? I mean, were they from this Earth? I mean, what were they?
Well, again, it depends who you speak to. I mean, you know, they will not deny. The Soviet military were under the sort of umbrella of the Academy of Sciences. You know, and I was fortunate to have two scientists from the Academy of Sciences come and stay with me back in the 90s. There was Dr. Yuli Platov and Dr. Sergei Chenow, and they were part of the official UFO research program. They lectured in the UK. As far as I'm aware, they're the only two scientists from Russia ever to do that. They were quite skeptical. You know, I have to admit, they weren't convinced that these were of an extraterrestrial nature, but they did admit that there were sightings that remained unidentified, but that's as far as they would go, and, you know, they would say. However, there are other scientists in Russia and pilots and so on. Marina Popovich, for example, she was like the female Top Gun of Russia, if you like. Her and her husband was also an astronaut. She's of the opposite opinion. She claimed they were of an extraterrestrial nature. So it depends on, you know, your point of view. But even the scientists who came to stay with me admitted that there were sightings that were unidentified.
Yeah.
That's as far as they would go.
Yeah. What's your website, Philip?
Just go philipmantle.com. That's my own website. And I publish my own articles on there. A link to it is an alien autopsy page with all the information about the alien autopsy film. So that's all on there. There's a nice big interview with Spiros on there as well.
What's your future plans on Philip?
Plans. At the moment, I'm still working on one or two interesting cases. But from a writing point of view, I've started to write a fictional account of the alien abduction scenario. I mean, my first book was called Without Consent, and it dealt with missing time and alien abduction accounts from Britain. So I've kind of combined a number of those cases and put them all into one story. I'm writing a fictional account. It's going to be a short story. It won't be a huge, great tome. It certainly won't be no great work of art. I'm not a fiction writer, but I've just thought I'll try and do that. It's just something I wanted to do. But last year, there was a chap by the name of Wing Commander Alan Turner contacted me. And Commander Turner told me about some UFOs he tracked on radar while... it's still employed by the Royal Air Force. And as a result of that, one or two other military officers have come forward from the RAF. So I'm following up a few of those stories as well. So that's going to keep me occupied for a while, both of those two.
That sounds very interesting, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, Wing Commander Turner worked with an awful lot of people. And when we released his story, I mean, he even came to speak at our conference. It was the one and only time he's ever spoken about it in public. And he's who he says he is, a long, distinguished military career in the RAF. I mean, a wing commander is a very senior, you know, officer. And he tracked a number of objects on radar. So when we released his story, again, it went in various publications around the world. But what we're waiting for now is that this, I think it's later this year, the next batch of Ministry of Defence files are to be released, which will cover this particular dates in time. So we're hoping that Their reports that they've filed will be in the release files that are coming up later this year from the MOD. It'll be interesting because Wing Commander Turner's, although he officially reported it, he's not in the MOD files. So, you know, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you would perhaps say, well, where is it then?
Yeah.
It's not in those files. It should be.
Indeed.
So we're waiting to see if these other ones are. And I mean, they are on the record, you know, and like I say, quite literally just had some more RAF officers come forward, which I'm going to follow up shortly.
And what sort of area in the UK was this covering? I mean, was that particularly
well,
the south?
I mean, Wing Commander Turner was down south, and his radar covered a huge area, and he also confirmed it with Heathrow. So, you know, because they were linked to both military and civil. You have to understand that the radar that he operated, and such was his security clearance, that at the time, the most secret airplane in the world was the spy planes from America, and they used to land in the UK, but nobody was supposed to know. But Wing Commander Turner did. He was informed when these planes were coming into land. So his security clearance was top notch.
Fairly high.
He tracked six UFOs over mainland Britain, you know, that he could not identify.
Philip, we're at the bottom of the hour there, so thank you so much for joining us today. Philip's books are currently available on amazon.co.uk. Just type in Philip Mantle or visit his site at www.philipmantle.co.uk. Well, until next time, be safe.